Next, in the matter of Jesse Cohn, please step forward. May we please have appearances?
Good afternoon, David Birnbaum, B-I-R-N-B-A-U-M, Alan S. Birnbaum, at Jesse Cohn.
And is Mr. Cohen next to you?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, good afternoon.
Mr. Cohen, you'll have an opportunity, because this is a potential disbarment matter, to address the court after your counsel does, and you can speak to one another privately to decide whether you'd like to do so. You need not. It's just an option afforded to you. Mr. Felsenstein.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Ravner, Associate Justices. I'm going to be a little repetitive, so I apologize. Some of the argument is the same, so bear with me. The OAE comes before this court following receipt of an order requiring respondent Jesse Cohn to show cause why he should not be disbarred or otherwise disciplined. It is the position of the Office of Attorney Ethics that is recommended by the DRB that respondent's disbarment is appropriate for respondent's conviction of mail and wire fraud and his knowing misappropriation of law firm funds under In re Siegel and RPCs 8.4B and 8.4C. For over 2 years, respondent, while an associate at a law firm, conspired with another attorney, Scott Diamond, at the same firm to defraud the firm. Respondent and Diamond defrauded the firm of legal fees and reimbursement of costs, diverting monies to bank accounts controlled by Diamond. Checks were intercepted, computer records changed by deleting records and making false computer entries. The two would leverage personal injury and subrogation cases they personally handled in order to conceal their crimes. Respondent would advise when a case was settling so that it could be used in the scheme. Respondent admitted that their scheme generated more than $750,000 in gross proceeds, and after disbursements to clients and payment of costs, they equally divided approximately $319,000. Additionally, Diamond separately diverted funds from the firm, improperly billing clients for his own personal expenses. Respondent Cohen pled guilty to mail and wire fraud in violation of 18 U.S.C. sections 1341 and 1343. The facts support respondent's disbarment under In re Siegel and In re Goldberg, where this court found that some crimes are so divergent from what it means to be an attorney, crimes such as theft and fraud motivated by greed, using the lawyer's skills to carry it out, that disbarment is the only appropriate discipline. Respondent argues that his actions are analogous to the attorney in re Sigmund, and that he has mitigating factors. But as the DRB correctly set forth, respondent has not presented any compelling mitigating factors. Respondent argues that Pennsylvania gave him a 4-year suspension, so New Jersey should simply follow along. Respondent ignores In re Goldberg. Respondent was not owed any money from his firm. Respondent had no business dispute with with the firm. He was paid every penny that it was agreed to that he be paid. It was $65,000 a year plus origination percentage. Respondent chose to steal hundreds of thousands of dollars from the firm. With the assistance of Diamond, he took whatever he could with no care until he left the firm and he was caught. The record is clear, and this court should disbar respondent to maintain public confidence in the system. And with that, if there's any questions.
I want to make sure that I'm not confusing apples and oranges. We've heard about Mr. Diamond's conduct in taking and billing for personal expenses to clients. That was just Mr. Diamond or Mr.
Cohen? That was just Mr. Diamond. Mr. Cohen
referenced it again, and I just wanted to make sure that that was the last case, not this.
Yes, I was just referencing to give the overall scheme, but that is not what Mr. Cohen did, not downplaying what he did, but that's not part of his.
Thank you. Questions, anyone?
I do have one. Counsel, you said that this all started based upon a letter that was provided to Mr. Cohen.
No, that was a letter to Mr. Diamond.
Mr. Diamond, I'm sorry. I apologize.
So,
And that when the chief asked you about that, you said, well, that was just to try and help him get a mortgage. Right. Was there no intention to really pay the money that was owed that letter? And if so, was that letter then intended to be somewhat sort of a disingenuous representation to a mortgage company?
It might very well have been, Justice Hoffman. That was part of the testimony of Mr. Weston during the plea and sentencing hearings in federal court. So I don't know everything that went into it. That's how it was testified to, that it was done for that purpose. So whether that is a fraud on Mr. Weston's part or whatever, that That I can't say, but that has nothing to do with Mr. Cohen. That was...
Other than the fact that that was the origination of the scheme.
That's the origination of the scheme as Mr. Diamond would have it. Mr. Cohen had no dispute, as he has said, all he had no dispute with the firm. He may have been unhappy that he wasn't getting, as probably everybody in the world's unhappy, they want more money, but he was getting paid what he was supposed to get paid as per the agreement. He just decided to take it to the criminal world.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
Brinko?
Mr. Chief Justice and Associate Justices, may it please the court. We are here today to discuss the discipline of Mr. Jesse Cohen, admitted to practice law in the state of New Jersey in 2004. Mr. Cohen's guilty pleas to both mail and wire fraud under the federal statute established that he has violated professional rule of conduct 8.4. The issue before the court today is not whether or not Mr. Cohen violated an ethical rule, and it is not whether or not discipline should be assessed. It is whether or not disbarment is the appropriate discipline that should be assessed. The issue is, moreover, whether Mr. Cohen's conduct warrants a departure from the discipline that was assessed in our sister jurisdiction of Pennsylvania, and that is pursuant to our ethical rule 1.20-14A4. It provides how New Jersey assesses final discipline in cases where discipline originated in a sister jurisdiction for conduct that occurred in that sister jurisdiction. Specifically, the rule states that the board shall recommend the imposition of identical action or discipline unless it clearly appears, and then there's five enumerated possibilities, four of which I think very clearly don't apply to this case. One is being that the disciplinary order was not entered. There was, in fact, a disciplinary order entered in Pennsylvania suspending Mr. Cohen for 4 years. That order was entered on 1/12/24, retroactive to 9/8/22. Next, B, the disciplinary order of the foreign jurisdiction does not apply to the respondent. Clearly, Mr. Cohen has been suspended in Pennsylvania, so it applies to him. C, the disciplinary order in the foreign jurisdiction does not remain in full force as a result of appellate proceedings. This was a joint order between the Pennsylvania Ethics Board and Mr. Cohen, so that's not applicable here either. The procedure followed in the foreign jurisdiction was so lacking in notice or opportunity to be heard as to constitute a deprivation of due process. Also not applicable here, Mr. Cohen, again, jointly filed for that four-year suspension. The final one, which I believe the meat of what we're here today for, is the unethical conduct established warrants substantially different discipline. The Office of Ethics has to establish that by clear and convincing evidence. It is our position that while Mr. Cohen's actions are abhorrent, they're not sufficiently horrific as to warrant a permanent disbarment under this situation. And for that, we do rely on some of the case law in Reese Sigmund. In the Sigmund case, there was, again, an issue of an attorney taking funds that belonged to his law firm employer, and that also took place in Philadelphia. The Sigmund court held that substantially different discipline that was assessed in Pennsylvania was not warranted, and there was a 30-month suspension in Pennsylvania. Like Mr. Sigmund, Mr. Cohen misappropriated law firm funds in violation of our ethical rules. But there were five mitigating factors that the court considered in the Sigmund case. Four of them are clearly applicable here, and then there are some other differences between Sigmund and Cohen that I think are relevant. The first was no prior history of discipline. Mr. Cohen's been practicing law from 2004 in the state of New Jersey and the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and up until the current actions had no prior discipline. Significant contributions to the community. Mr. Cohen, as was referenced by Judge Brody in the federal court at his sentencing, had a significant impact on the community through his work in Big Brothers Big Sisters. Mr. Cohen also was active with the bar through the National Association of Subrogation Professionals. And following his suspension, rather than, and I think this is notable, rather than doing what so many of my colleagues who are suspended do and take a paralegal position at an inflated salary where they can practice law under the guise of supervision, Mr. Cohen did not do that. Mr. Cohen is heading up an art foundation in California. It's a nonprofit organization that helps underserved youth through art. And actually, his folder here today is one of the pieces of art from one of the kids, which I thought very interesting. It's an organization called Mountain of Angels, and they do very good work. Another factor was cooperation with disciplinary authorities. Mr. Cohen did not just immediately and fully cooperate with the criminal investigation, but the U.S. Attorney's Office actually entered a 5K1 motion in his favor at the sentencing. A 5K1 motion is something that is given to criminal defendants in federal court when they have substantially cooperated with authorities in ways that are especially helpful to the U.S. Attorney's Office. These are very serious motions, and they are not given lightly, but it was given in this case, and Judge Brody did depart from the sentencing guidelines, where Mr. Cohen was able to not receive a prison sentence as a result and just probation. The next is that no allegation of money being stolen from a client. I think that's very important here, though it's not better or worse to steal money from one person versus another person. In terms of protecting the public from Mr. Cohen's conduct, Mr. Cohen did not, and there has not been an allegation that he misappropriated any client funds. The difference, obviously, is the lack of presence of a legitimate business dispute. Mr. Cohen is not going to attempt to create a legitimate business dispute where one doesn't exist for self-serving purposes. He is going to state that his actions were wholly inappropriate and that there was no legitimate business dispute. However, I'm going to read a quote from the case. This court's held, we conclude that the sanction of disbarment should not turn on whether an attorney contends his misappropriation of firm cases is justified as a form of self-help in an ongoing business dispute with his partners about compensation. So while the business dispute would certainly be a factor, it's not intended to be dispositive. And there are other differences between Mr. Sigmund's case and Mr. Cohen's case that fall in line with Mr. Cohen's favor. A special note, in Mr. Sigmund's case, there was an incident where a member of the public was harmed as a result of Mr. Sigmund's conduct. There was evidence that the respondent in that case admitted to testifying falsely regarding a case that involved a client's property dispute. And in doing so, he perjured himself, and he did so at the expense of his client. Again, there's no evidence and there's been no accusation that Mr. Cohen did anything client adverse. This does not excuse his conduct, but it is important that it was not client adverse, it was not adverse to the public. The Office of Attorney Ethics has to show by clear and convincing evidence that the discipline assessed in Pennsylvania is inappropriate in this case. This is not simply a matter of, well, Pennsylvania did it this way, so we think you should do it that way too. That's not what the rule provides. That's not what we are arguing. What we are arguing is that the rules provide that when a sister jurisdiction assesses discipline for conduct in its jurisdiction, absent clear and convincing evidence, we should follow that. All we are asking is that we do so under the rules. Thank you.
Counsel, do you know, will your client address the court?
He will, Your Honor.
Okay. Questions, anyone? Thank you.
Thank you. And if I may, this is my first time arguing before you all, and I just want to take this opportunity to say that I'm humbled and awestruck at the opportunity. So thank you.
Happy to welcome you. Cohen.
Good afternoon, Justices. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to address you. I will keep it very brief. Mr. Birnbaum, my attorney, who started out many years ago as my associate, did a phenomenal job of setting forth, I think, the facts and the law, and that's not what I'm here to do. I'm here, and I came here because it's important, I think, to see the people that we deal with in the law. I think there's an unfortunate habit in the world today, not just in the law, just in general, to not see people, but to see rules and policies and make decisions based on this is the rule and this is the policy. And I just think sometimes it's important to see the people that we're dealing with. And I just want you to understand that, first off, I am obviously extremely sorry and extremely regretful that this very, very, very extremely poor decision was made by me. And I don't blame Mr. Diamond. I don't try to blame Mr. Diamond. Yes, he was involved in it, but I made a decision. I'm responsible for that decision. What I would ask you to please consider is that in the aftermath of that decision, I realized the gravity of what had occurred, and I chose to take a particular course of action afterwards. Between cooperating with the U.S. Attorney's Office, between cooperating with Disciplinary Counsel's Office over a course of time, providing information about what occurred, not necessarily the, what is the word I want to use, not the sugar-coated version, but what actually occurred, and being very honest about money was taken and how it was taken and what was done with computer records and files and just all of that information. And then, like Mr. Bermo said...
Can I interrupt you just one second with a question? Mr. Felsenstein characterized the facts as that after you left the firm, they discovered what had been done. I forget exactly how he said it. And gave the impression that had they not investigated, this would not have been detected today. Did you come forward with this information to anyone, or were you, did the firm discover the misconduct and seek the assistance of the U.S. Attorney's Office? Or
the firm, there was a couple steps in between there. The firm discovered a fee that was missing. They confronted Mr. Diamond. Mr. Diamond called me. I spoke to an attorney, at which point we took steps to make sure that the firm knew that we would be cooperative. So I hired an attorney. That attorney spoke to Mr. Weston, and there were discussions immediately before the U.S. attorney was involved with Mr. Weston about cooperating and trying to rectify the situation.
Mr. Cohen, why did you decide to participate in this fraudulent scheme?
To be very honest with you, complete desperation. It was, when I tell you, one of the most dysfunctional relationships of a business I have ever seen in my entire life. I have never seen anything like it. Just three people that were all just completely at each other physically, mentally. I shouldn't say physically, I mean, not hitting each other, but just distrust. Trust and dishonesty and just, and again, I'm not trying to blame anyone. I'm just to answer your question as forthright as possible. It was just a very extraordinarily dysfunctional relationship.
Why did you make the decision that the solution was to take funds?
Because there was a lot of similar to what the one similarity of what Mr. Diamond alleged, which was that there were always these promises that money would be coming in and that things would be solved. And I felt there was nowhere to go with my business, my practice. I had all these subrogation clients and I had all this work going on, and there was never any money coming in from those cases. All that money was going into the firm, but there was no support coming back in terms of staffing or in terms of compensation, in terms of just what was going in from the fees versus what was going home with me at the end of the day, and just complete desperation.
And sometimes lawyers find themselves in that position and they leave. You didn't leave.
I did not. And again, not to make excuses, just extreme, I don't want to say fear, but Mr. Sachs has an enormous quantity of money and has the ability through Mr. Weston, who is a phenomenal litigator, one of the best litigators I have ever seen in my entire life at all levels of trial, appellate. He's extraordinarily skilled, and his skill combined with Mr. Sachs's money puts them in a position to put somebody out of business. And again, it's not an excuse. That was what I felt at the time. Sitting here with you today, I am not saying that as an excuse. I'm saying that was the mindset that I was in at that time. I realize the error of that now, but that's where I was at that moment.
Go ahead, please.
And I appreciate the questions and the opportunity to explain. The only other thing I was going to say was, so in addition to the cooperation, I just want you to consider sort of the shift that I have made in my life. And like Mr. Barrymore said, instead of trying to sort of hang on by a thread and go work as a paralegal in a law firm, I would ask you to consider how I have switched gears and have been able to establish, through the help of some friends, setting up this foundation in California. We've been running for 2.5 years now. We've helped a number of kids directly through one-on-one support that the foundation funds. We've done a number of large-scale community art events in Los Angeles that have engaged underserved portions of the public, and provided them a voice and an opportunity to share their art with the greater public. And I just would ask that you see that as an indication that maybe I'm a person that still has some good left to do while I'm still here. And I think to have that opportunity to still be able to redeem myself for a very, very poor decision and still be able to do some good.
You intend to practice law in New Jersey in the future, if the opportunity is permitted?
Again, to be very honest with you, I don't know. I'm very, very committed to this foundation, and I'm very, very committed to what we're doing. I think it's important to have the ability to be able to, right? If the foundation grows, if other things happen where we start to evolve, and I'm doing business with the foundation in Pennsylvania, in New Jersey, I would very much appreciate at least having the ability to be able to come into court into New Jersey. But to be very honest with you, Chief Justice, do I think full time as a litigator? I think probably not.
Questions, anyone? Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Thank
Court's
you.
In recess for the day.